Good morning. Welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane. Unprecedented, sinister and dodgy. They're the words some constitutional experts and politicians are using to describe Scott Morrison's decision to secretly appoint himself to numerous ministerial roles during his time as Prime Minister. The Albanese government's now seeking legal advice, but could the actions of the former PM wind up being investigated by the soon-to-be-established Federal Anti-Corruption Body? Here's political reporter Claudia Long.
There's usually a ceremony and some media coverage when a politician is sworn in as minister.
You're now the 30th Prime Minister of the Commonwealth of Australia. Congratulations.
Thank you.
But that wasn't the case when then-Prime Minister Scott Morrison secretly appointed himself as the Minister for Health, Minister for Resources and Minister for Finance as the COVID pandemic unfolded. Only Health Minister Greg Hunt apparently knew about some of it.
It sure as heck seems very, very dodgy. And most questionable, and I feel quite alarmed by it.
Independent MP Helen Haynes has long pushed for a federal integrity commission, but isn't yet certain whether Scott Morrison's actions could be investigated by a corruption watchdog.
Now, what we don't know about this particular episode is, well, we don't know much at all. What we don't know is, you know, could the Prime Minister have been in breach of any ministerial code? Well, we didn't know that he was acting as a minister. You know, there's so many questions here that at the moment remain unanswered that it's impossible to say whether this would ever come before an integrity commission.
A spokesperson for the Attorney-General, Mark Dreyfus, says the soon-to-be-established Federal Anti-Corruption Body will be independent and it'll decide what to investigate. Helen Haynes thinks Scott Morrison should explain himself.
If the Prime Minister is not being transparent and honest about who's making decisions in key portfolio areas, then we are left in a most parlous situation. I think this is truly alarming. I am really disturbed by this.
Former Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull puts it more bluntly.
This is one of the most appalling things I've ever heard in our federal government. I mean, I'm astonished that Morrison thought he could do it. I'm astonished that Prime Minister and Cabinet went along with it. That's the department. And I'm even more astonished that the Governor-General was party to it. I mean, this is sinister stuff.
Technically, this looks like it's probably, strictly speaking, legal, but it is inconsistent with constitutional convention.
Associate Professor of Constitutional Law at Monash University, Luke Beck, says while it was legal, there are other implications.
These are the unwritten rules that govern how things run. And convention in this country is that the identity of ministers is published in the Gazette, that the identity of ministers is known to Parliament.
And he says the secret appointments expose a loophole that must be closed.
There's clearly a flaw in our system of relying on unwritten constitutional conventions. I think at the very least, the current Parliament needs to pass a law that requires every time the Governor-General appoints somebody to a ministry or to an extra ministry, that be published in the Gazette.
A spokesperson for the Governor-General, David Hurley, has confirmed the appointments and says they were consistent with the Constitution.
Which is quite an extraordinary statement. It suggests that the Governor-General is aware of this kind of thing having happened before. On what dates did he appoint Mr. Morrison to particular ministries? And on what occasions, if any, did the Governor-General appoint other people to ministries that were not published?
The Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, has asked his department to seek legal advice from the Solicitor General.
Claudia Long reporting. For nearly 40 years, secret committees have helped the Queensland government decide which areas are declared in drought, a classification that can trigger financial assistance for farmers and graziers. But a recent decision to lift a drought declaration in one shire has some questioning whether these drought committees should exist at all. Victoria Pengilly filed this report from Huindon in outback Queensland.
For third generation sheep grazier Jay McNamara, drought is always on her mind.
I was 7 years old before it rained for 24 hours, and apparently I was like, Daddy, Daddy, is it ever going to stop? it's a weird sensation when you have drought. It just creeps up on you.
She runs around 5,000 merinos on her property south of Huindon in northwest Queensland. After a decade of patchy rain, she'd hoped recent storms would replenish her pastures, but the season's been a disappointment.
If you look at the rainfall charts for this year, it'll probably tell you that we've had a reasonable season. But the problem was that we didn't have it in the early part of the year. And there's three dams here on Abbotsford and two of them that creek hasn't even run.
Jay McNamara is also mayor of Flinders Shire. And you might think that position would keep her in the loop. But a recent decision to take the Shire off the drought list came as a complete surprise. It was a call from the ABC that delivered the news.
I think it could at least do an email to the affected Shire mayors just to let them know.
For almost 40 years, secret committees have helped the Queensland government decide who remains in drought across the state. The groups consist of local producers and industry specialists. But graziers say the decision to take Flinders Shire off the drought list shows the committees are outdated and out of touch, and they're calling for change.
It's not that I'm asking for Flinders to be put back onto the drought list. It's just that I think that the system is quite flawed, and it's probably not giving a true picture of what's happening in the district.
The committees are kept secret to protect the identities of members. But down the road in the tiny town of Prairie, that's no longer passing the pub test at the local hotel. Cattle grazier Bob Bode agrees that lifting the drought status was premature.
I think that they might have jumped the gun a bit because there's been like 8 or 9 years or more people in drought down there. And they need to get out and have a bit of a look. You know, it's hit and miss around the place.
Having a drought declaration means access to crucial financial support when times are tough. With 45% of Queensland still in drought, many believe a review is long overdue. But the State Minister for Agriculture, Mark Ferner, insists the committees are doing their job.
I think they've served their communities very well over the past, both before my time and during my time as the Agriculture Minister.
Back in Hughenden, Jay McNamara is tending to her stock. And with no review in sight, she's counting the days until more rain.
I don't blame the people that are on the drought committees. I just want to put that out there. I just think everything else gets reviewed. Why not this?
Grazier and Flinders Shire Mayor Jane McNamara ending that report from Victoria Pingilly. And while some want rain along the east coast, I know many will wince at this news. There could be another summer of heavy rains and devastating floods ahead. The probability of a third consecutive La Nina event is increasing, and some scientists say it's more likely than not. John Daly reports.
This might be the other floods.
In Marlene Renke's home office, reams of paperwork detail the damage left by floods on her family's farm near the Queensland town of Grantham.
Left high and dry by flood relief.
The thought of another scares her.
Horror. Frightened. It's disaster. Mm. We lost a dog in 2011. The flood came so quickly and he drowned. Yeah, it's a very emotional thing because my cousin, water went up to her guttering. She says every time there's a flood or rains, she panics.
The Renke family would normally keep cattle and grow hay on their farm. Glenn Renke says they've not had an income from the property since the last floods in February.
Well, we can't get on the ground. We planted once and then the second flood come and it washed it out again.
So when you see predictions of, you know, another wet spring and summer, how do you feel?
Oh, not looking real good. Not much else we can do about it. You can't stop it.
The US Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration has lifted the risk of a third consecutive La Nina event based on changes in atmospheric conditions and Pacific Ocean temperatures. Agus Santoso is an associate investigator at the Australian Research Council's Centre of Excellence for Climate Extremes. He says another La Nina is now more likely than not.
Back a few months ago, it was 50 to 60%, and now has increased, probably increased by about 5 to 10%. A triple La Nina is actually quite rare. It has happened two times since 1950s.
Adding to the likelihood of another sodden spring and summer is a climate driver in the Indian Ocean, known as the Indian Ocean Dipole. It's now in a negative phase, meaning heavy spring rains for the southeast of Australia. Matthew England is a climate scientist at the University of New South Wales.
Yeah, so it means for the eastern seaboard, so from Queensland right down to Victoria, that we'd expect to have higher than average rainfall conditions. And so the Indian Ocean Dipole aspect, that negative Indian Ocean Dipole would bring the heavy rains down to sort of southeast Australia around Victoria, southern New South Wales, and La Nina would tend to hit the Queensland, New South Wales.
And with higher than average rains comes heightened risk of floods.
The odds of those events just ramp up dramatically with the La Nina event. And obviously two summers in a row, we had catastrophic floods at different parts of the eastern seaboard. The chances of that occurring again are much, much higher with a third La Nina.
Authorities in Queensland are already telling the public to prepare for another summer of flooding. The Bureau of Meteorology will update its outlook for La Niña later today.
John Daly reporting. Calls are growing in Western Australia for the state to bring in its own redress scheme for survivors of the Stolen Generations. There are more than 30,000 Stolen Generations survivors in Australia, and 6,000 of those are in WA. In recent years, all states except WA and Queensland have set up redress schemes, and survivors are pushing for that to change. Isabel Masali reports.
Menangarang man Tony Hansen is the oldest of seven children. But as kids in WA South in the 1970s, they were separated from their family and each other. He was taken to a nearby mission and says the experience had a profound effect on him.
You weren't allowed to talk about your culture. You weren't allowed to have family contact. It was like being in prison. When your time was up, you're shown the door and you walked out into the real world to find yourself and really try to establish yourself and then find your family.
Why do you believe a redress payment is needed for you and other Stolen Generation survivors?
I believe that it's about righting the wrongs of the past. You know, we talk about we're the wealthiest place in this country, we're the one of the wealthiest places in the world. Why don't we right the wrongs and acknowledge the wrongs of the past government?
Tony Hansen is part of a growing group of survivors petitioning the West Australian government to set up a redress scheme. Other groups behind the petition include the Kimberley Stolen Generation Aboriginal Corporation and national body The Healing Foundation. He wants not only individual payments, as seen in other states, but also funding for counselling. Associate Professor Stephanie Gilbert from the University of Queensland agrees redress schemes are important and says it's time for WA to introduce one.
People now are still 25 years on from the Bring Them Home report saying this is an issue. We have to hear that. Maybe we haven't spent enough time focusing in the moment saying we acknowledge that you suffered.
Stephanie Gilbert has spent years researching the impact of the Stolen Generations policies. As a member of the Stolen Generations herself, she went through the reparations scheme in New South Wales.
One of the things I received was this a letter to me which said that we are prepared to publicly apologise to you in front of other people. And I find it very difficult to have the words to explain what that means to me because it legitimises the whole experience of it.
In a statement, WA Aboriginal Affairs Minister Tony Booty said the government will consider the petition. He went on to say, "The forced removal of Aboriginal children from their families, their country and their culture is one of the most shameful chapters in Australian history, which has resulted in trauma and pain." And he said WA's most recent state budget allocated more than $600 million for initiatives aimed at closing the gap.
Isabel Masali reporting. The 12-month anniversary of the United States' withdrawal from Afghanistan has sparked renewed criticism about how it was handled. Republicans in Congress are preparing to release a report detailing what they describe as a series of failures by the State Department, while others are warning of a humanitarian catastrophe still facing the country. Here's North America correspondent Jade McMillan.
Outside the former US embassy in Kabul, members of the Taliban marked 1 year since they captured Afghanistan's capital.
We're feeling very happy. We always had a vision of a free and prosperous Afghanistan, and that's what we've been fighting for over the past 20 years. Today, as we see the end result of the struggle, it's like a dream come true.
For millions of others, though, the past 12 months have been marked by poverty, malnutrition, and a loss of hope. Ramiz Alakbarov is the UN's humanitarian coordinator for Afghanistan.
We are talking about chronically half of the population, about 20 million people, in constant need of some sort of support, either nutritional or other essential basic life needs support. Without recovery of economy, without functional banking system, there is no future, and Afghanistan will not move from surviving to any sort of thriving.
Metra Mehran, a fellow at New York University's Center for Global Affairs, has told Washington-based think tank the Hudson Institute the situation is especially dire for many women and girls.
One thing that we can say is
people of Afghanistan, especially women, are stripped of their human dignity. They don't have access to education, to employment. Freedom of movement is taken away from them.
State Department spokesman Ned Price insists the US is fulfilling its commitment to continue to support the people of Afghanistan. And he's defended the way in which American forces left the country.
Ending the longest war in American history was never going to be easy. But 1 year later, we are in a stronger position as a country because of the president's decision.
But some Republicans are scathing. The party's representatives on the House Foreign Affairs Committee are set to release a report accusing the administration of being badly prepared, arguing it failed to send in enough consular officials to assist with the evacuation in which 13 American troops and nearly 200 Afghans were killed. Republican Congressman Michael McCaul spoke to Fox News.
This was an absolute failure. A strategic failure by the State Department and the White House.
The State Department disputes a number of the report's findings, but hasn't yet released its own detailed review of the withdrawal. Ned Price says it's classified, but pledged some sections should be made public soon. This is Jade McMillan in Washington, reporting for AM.
The UK is the first country to approve a new COVID vaccine that specifically targets both the original and the Omicron variants. The Moderna vaccine will be part of a new booster campaign ahead of the European winter, as Catherine Gregory reports.
There have been many mutations to COVID-19 since it first emerged in China in late 2019, each new variant causing surges in cases around the world. So far, the vaccines have targeted that original strain, but now there's another option on the table, a Moderna shot that targets both it and Omicron variants.
What this vaccine helps to do is it gives us another piece of armoury, really, another tool in the box.
Darius Hughes is the general manager of Moderna in the UK. He's pleased the UK has become the first country to approve the use of what's called the bivalent vaccine.
To make sure that we're protecting the British public over this autumn and winter when they get their boosters against the ever-evolving production and the ever-evolving virus.
This new vaccine works on the first Omicron variant, BA1. But Moderna says clinical trials show it's not only safe, but also more effective in protecting people against the latest Omicron subvariants too. Darius Hughes says the benefit of the RNA technology is that it can be adapted.
Once the virus is mutated again, we can create another sequence, we can get another messenger RNA sequence ready, and we can formulate that one. And then depending on where the virus goes and how much disease it's causing, we can put that one in additionally to this vaccine, or we can replace and return again.
Britain's health authorities want to use the bivalent shot for its autumn booster program, starting with frontline workers and people over 50 to prepare for rising cases in the coming winter. Professor Lim Wei Shen is from the UK's Joint Committee on Vaccine and Immunisation.
The difference between having a booster vaccine and not having a booster vaccine is much larger and much more important than any difference between vaccine types. In other words, if you're offered a vaccine, please take up the offer and be vaccinated, because that is the important message.
Australian infectious diseases expert Professor Paul Griffin says the bivalent vaccine is the first step towards improving our defences against COVID.
To just keep changing it to try and keep pace with the emergence of new subvariants is going to be challenging. What we need is from here is another improvement in our vaccines. And there's around 170 vaccines still in clinical trials. So I think over the course of next year, we'll get so-called second generation vaccines with additional improvements. Some of which might be that they're less susceptible to reduced protection from new emerging subvariants, so we don't have to keep tweaking the vaccine. Some of these new ones might just continue to work well even as the virus continues to change.
He thinks Australia won't be too far behind in approving the new Moderna shot, but urges people in the meantime to get any booster that's available.
Catherine Gregory, and that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. When Scott Morrison was Prime Minister, he was leading a parliament dogged by allegations of sexual harassment and misconduct. But since the election, there's a new force in town, with a record number of women winning parliamentary crossbench seats. Today, Four Corners reporter Louise Milligan on her fly-on-the-wall access to some of them. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.